who is the Chief Operating Officer at the Mobile Area Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for joining us today. We know these are challenging times, and we know that you are working hard to manage your way through the crises. This call is about providing you information and resources that will help you through today's challenges. It's a muted call because of the number of callers we have today, but we will take your questions by email. If you will email me directly at bob@mobilechamber.com, bob@mobilechamber.com, there will also be a recording of this conversation from this morning's call, and it will be posted later today to the Chamber's social media channels, so you'll have a chance to re-listen or share it accordingly. Our guest today is Emily Killian. She's an attorney with the law firm of Burr Foreman and practices in the firm's labor and employment group. Emily joins us today to present key aspects of the Family First Coronavirus Act, especially as they impact family medical leave and paid sick leave. Emily, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Bob, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me on. I'm excited to talk to you guys today. Like Bob said, I wanted to focus the conversation today on a piece of new federal legislation that goes into effect tomorrow. And it's sort of funny. It is not, in fact, an April Fool's joke. This is going into effect tomorrow, and it's a wide-ranging piece of legislation that is going to affect many local employers. So we want to make sure that we give some bits of information. Some of this information is pretty nuanced. Of course, we're able to help employers assess their needs and obligations as it pertains to their specific circumstances, but we want to hit the highlights today. So I'll just jump right in, Bob. Like you said, the legislation is titled the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, and I'm going to refer to that as FCRA, but basically, this act has a number of different pieces of legislation within it, but there are two key pieces that stand out the most for employers in terms of their immediate and relevancy. The first of these is titled the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act, and the second is the Emergency Family and Medical Leave Expansion Act. So I think let's first talk about what's titled the Emergency Paid Sick Leave Act. And I'll probably just call that Paid Sick Leave Act, but both of these pieces of legislation apply certain job-protected paid leave for circumstances related to coronavirus. So this Paid Sick Leave Act applies to employers with fewer than 500 employees. So as you can imagine, that is a huge percentage of all employers. So really it's exempting the largest of employers, but large, medium, small, those types of employers are subject to this act. There is one note that if you are an employer with fewer than 50 employees, there might be a potential exemption for your business under the FCRA Act. I say might be because, as you can imagine, you know, the act is very new. We're still interpreting the language of the act without much guidance from the Department of Labor yet. We anticipate that we'll have more guidance in the coming days and weeks, but for now, we're still kind of piecing together what the language of the act means. What we know is that if you are an employer with fewer than 50 employees, there might be an exemption for you if you are able to demonstrate to the Department of Labor that compliance with FCRA stands to jeopardize the viability of your business, either financially or in a staffing sense, meaning if I allow all my employees this leave, I literally will have no one left to help me run and operate my business. These are going to be very fact-specific types of analyses that are going to have to be well-documented to the Department of Labor. So if you have fewer than 50 employees, our guidance at this point is to assume that you are required to comply. And down the road, once there's clear guidance from the Department of Labor about this exemption, it might be that you can seek that exemption at that time. But for now, we're saying everyone be ready on tomorrow for this April 1 effective date. So let's turn a little bit to the specifics of this Paid Leave Act. So essentially what this allows is all employees, and again, I say all employees, this is not a situation where you have to have worked for the employer for a year, anything like that. There is a little bit of an exemption for certain employees under the FMLA that we're going to talk about in a second, but for this Paid Sick Leave Act, all of your employees are going to be eligible. It allows your employees to take up to 80 hours for full-time employees, and for part-time employees, a number of hours, basically the average of hours that they work over a two-week period. It gives them paid leave for different qualifying circumstances related to coronavirus. The different ones that we're looking at are your employee is subject to some type of quarantine or isolation order. Your employee has been advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine. The employee is actually experiencing symptoms of coronavirus and is seeking a diagnosis. The employee is caring for an individual, meaning anyone, not just a family member, an individual who is subject to an isolation order or who has been advised to self-quarantine. The other instance is that the employee is required to provide child care for their child, meaning their own son or daughter, if the school or their care provider is closed due to coronavirus, which we know is a wide-ranging requirement from Governor Ivey right now. So basically, if your employee is faced with one of these different circumstances, an isolation order, child care issues, experiencing symptoms of COVID, they are entitled to up to 80 hours for full-time employees of their pay for paid leave. So essentially, that's about 2 weeks of paid leave. One thing that I want to note here is that for both the Paid Sick Leave Act and for the EFMLA, the Emergency Family Medical Leave Expansion, any payment made by an employer under these acts is going to be subject to a tax credit. And again, this is another aspect that we're waiting for additional guidance from the Department of Labor and the IRS on, but there will be specific documentation that will be required to demonstrate the different payments that were made, but there will be some clawback for the employer for payments made under this Paid Sick Leave Act. Okay, so turning now to the Emergency Family Medical Leave Expansion Act. This one, I think, is ripe for confusion among employers. So I want to break it down just a little bit. Typically, we're all used to what the FMLA is. If you have a child, if you have a serious health condition, you're entitled to 12 weeks of job-protected, unpaid leave. Well, what the federal government has done is basically provided an expansion of those rights under normal FMLA. So one main difference, though, that I think employers might get confused on is normally if you have an employee who has not worked for you for a year or who has not worked 1,250 hours, and that's very specific, but if you have an employee that hasn't met these very specific eligibility requirements, they aren't entitled to normal FMLA. Well, that's a lot different here dealing with this emergency FMLA. If you have an employee who has worked for you for at least 30 days as of the date of their request for leave, so let's say they come to you on April 15th and ask for emergency FMLA leave. If they work for you for 30 days prior to that request on April 15th, they're eligible. So this is going to cover a lot more employees than does typical FMLA. So I want to make that clear from the outset. What this allows is it allows an employee who, in the very specific circumstance that they lack child care due to school closures, child care closures, daycare closures, you know, whatever. If they can demonstrate that their place of care for their child under the age of 18 has been closed or is unavailable to COVID, then they are entitled to up to 12 weeks of job-protected and partially paid leave. So the first 10 days of this leave, so if an employee comes to you on April 15th and applies and is eligible for EFMLA, the emergency FMLA, the first 10 days of that leave, so essentially the first two of the 12 weeks, is unpaid. It's job protected, but it's unpaid. After that, for weeks 3 through 12, the employee is entitled to two-thirds of their regular rate of pay. And, you know, the quote-unquote regular rate of pay, that has specific meaning under the law. And this is something, again, that your attorneys can help you assess for each employee. But that basically takes their total compensation over a six-month period divided by the number of hours that they worked. If you have a 40-hour-a-week employee, this is pretty easy to figure out. If you have an employee who works on commission, has an irregular schedule, those are the types of fax assessments that are going to be very specific and need to be delved into in a little more detail. But, again, for weeks 3 through 12, that employee would be entitled to two-thirds of their regular rate of pay and job-protected leave. Of course, you know, if we are dealing with a situation where the employee takes this leave starting April 1st, and it turns out that on May 1st, the governor puts the public schools back in effect, although I guess, I'm sorry, that's an inaccurate thing to say because we know now, unfortunately, I think I'm in denial about this too, but we know now that schools are not going into session. So let's say on May 1st, the employee's daycare opens, because that's under a different set of circumstances. Well, if the employee has access to the child care at any point in time during their requested leave, their entitlement to that leave ends. So it isn't just an automatic blanket 12 weeks entitlement because the school is closed right now. We know that public schools, and elementary schools, those types of schools, high schools are not going to open, but if your child has, if your employee has one child whose daycare becomes available, their eligibility for the ESMLA will end at that time. One other key point here that the Department of Labor has cleared up in the past couple of days is that if you have an employee who has already utilized 8 weeks of their FMLA entitlement, so again, under normal FMLA, an employee who meets the eligibility requirements is entitled to 12 weeks of unpaid leave. So say in January and February, you had an employee who utilized leave for the birth of a child, say for 8 weeks. Well, we now know from the Department of Labor that that employee is only entitled to 4 weeks of additional emergency FMLA leave. So if they have a child whose school is closed, their 12-week entitlement for ESMLA is reduced down by the number of weeks and the amount of leave that they may have used for normal FMLA. This is going to depend on how your business looks at FMLA. Some businesses use a rolling calendar year, meaning that if I make a request for FMLA on April 1st, the relevant time period will be April 1st of 2020 to April 1st of 2019. If your place of business uses a calendar year, it's going to be how much FMLA has an employee used from January 1, 2020 to the end of this calendar year. So, again, these are fact-specific determinations that will depend on your policies and how you do business. But in general, the Emergency Family Medical Leave Act does not allow the employee a whole new set of 12 weeks of leave. It's going to be deducted from what they've used before. And that's a big key because initially we had questions about the language of the act, about how that would be interpreted. So I think overall that will be a benefit for employers in the sense that the leave amount is limited. But overall, this is going to be something that's hard to track. There's going to be different feasibility measures that employers are going to have to put in place to make sure that they have their finger on the amount of leave that each employee is entitled to and how much the employee is using. To that end, one key point for both of this, for the ESMLA and for the Paid Sick Leave Act, is that We don't have a whole lot of documentation from either the Secretary of Treasury on the tax credit portion or the Secretary of Labor to give employers to figure out what kind of questions can I ask an employee, what kind of documentation can I request. Typically with FMLA, we have specific forms that the Department of Labor has promulgated for employers to put to use to handle those types of requests and to manage that leave. What we are advising employees and clients to do is to put a system into place that will help you document and manage, number one, the dates on which different leave requests are made, the amount of FMLA that each employee has available to them to use for potential eFMLA, the types of documentation that will be requested. For example, if you have someone saying that I need to care for my grandmother because she has been told by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine, that would be a circumstance that would trigger the Paid Sick Leave Act. Again, it's caring for any individual who has been advised to self-quarantine. Well, the employer in that instance is entitled to request a copy of that recommendation from that healthcare provider. These types of questions are going to be, I think, difficult for employers to figure out how to ask, what they can say, because typically the employer only in very certain specific instances delves into medical information, certainly not medical information of a person who is not the employee, him or herself. So I think having specific documentation in place, and this is something that your attorneys can help you with, having documentation and processes in place to help the employer figure out what can I ask, what do I have, can I deny this based on the lack of documentation or lack of support for what has been provided to me. Because unfortunately, we know that paid leave, accrued leave, PTO, FMLA, we know that, of course, there are worthy circumstances and honest employees, but we know that these systems are really ripe for abuse and are abused a lot of times by employees who really might not qualify or who are not giving the full story. So we want that to be, the minimal situation, but we have to be prepared for that in any case and arm ourselves with as much documentation and systems to prevent against that, both on the front end and, of course, if there is litigation on the back end related to some type of this leave. And that brings up a good point about litigation. If an employee utilizes paid leave or this expanded FMLA, emergency FMLA, for any of these instances related to coronavirus, they are protected from retaliation on the basis of their request for that leave. They're protected from discrimination on the basis of those requests for leave. And, of course, this is the same as it is for any other type of assessment that we make in the workplace. It's based on legitimate business reasons that are documented, never in discrimination and never in retaliation. But I do want to make clear that we have specific guidance from the Department of Labor that an employee who utilizes these types of leave under FCRA will be given that veil of protection in the law from retaliation and discrimination on that basis. So I wanted to point out one more thing, which is that if you are a covered employer, meaning you employ fewer than 500 employees, there is a poster that the Department of Labor has promulgated. It can be found on their website. Of course, your attorney can probably guide you to that poster. But just like we are required to do for other wage and hour issues, for the FMLA, the employer is required to post this document about the employee's rights under this FCRA in a conspicuous place within their workplace. So if that's in your lunchroom, in your break room, if you have a locker room, of course, you all are best equipped to know what the best place for that type of posting to appear would be, but that is a requirement for covered employees. So if you have questions, going back to what we talked about at the beginning, if you have questions about your status as a covered employer, that is something that you need to immediately get guidance on. The best course of action right now is until you can figure out whether or not your fewer than 50 employee status gives you an exemption. For now, you need to comply. That's going to be the safest course of action for you until you have that explicit exemption from the Department of Labor. And, unfortunately, we don't expect that to be a clear-cut or quick process, but we do anticipate, like I said, additional guidance from the Department of Labor in the coming days about the specific instances, when that specific exemption might be made, and how they will be documented. What we know for right now, like I said, is if you have fewer than 50 employees and you feel that compliance with the Act poses some type of jeopardy to the viability of your business, or alternatively would essentially leave you with no employees, that both of those are instances that the Department of Labor has clarified would be a viability issue. But again, how that's documented, what specific evidence the department is going to require, we don't know that quite yet. One other point I want to make is that this fewer than 500 employee threshold for covered employees pertains to private employers. If you work for a city, a local government, that type of agency, your employer, your city employer, is likely a covered employer, under the language of the Act. So this specific employee number test really pertains to private employers. And without getting too into the weeds of this, I know this is a threshold question that many employers are facing, but in determining whether you have fewer than 500 employees, one thing you need to consider is, do I have temporary employees that come to me through a staffing agency? Do I have other types of employees on my workplace that I need to count in terms of reaching this 500 employee threshold? These are all the considerations that you need to ask yourself. It might be that you have a relationship with some type of parent corporation. You're a subsidiary, and you're wondering, do I need to count the employees of my parent corporation to decide if I have to comply with this paid sick leave act, with this emergency FMLA leave? The question there, again, this is a very, very fact-specific analysis. It's what's called an integrated employer test under the law that evaluates the relationship between that parent corporation and that subsidiary to determine, is there a sufficient relationship between the two such that the employees of the parent corporation need to be counted towards that 500 employee threshold. So, again, lots of questions right at the outset to determine if you're a covered employer. These are very fact-specific. Your attorney can help you with this. But, again, this is a threshold question. Until you have an explicit answer, the best practice would be to assume that you have to comply beginning tomorrow, April 1. So that's the best guidance for now, but whether or not you're a covered employer obviously informs the rest of the determination. But like I said before, all employees are eligible for the Paid Sick Leave Act, meaning if they have one of the different six circumstances that they're dealing with, they have symptoms of COVID, they're caring for someone who has symptoms of COVID, they're subject to an isolation order, they have child care issues, et cetera. All employees are eligible for that paid sick leave. the difference for emergency FMLA leave is that your employee has to have been employed by you for more than 30 days as of the date of their leave request. So, again, we're dispelling with the normal FMLA assessment for eligibility, and we're looking at it that way. One final note is that normal FMLA still matters. We're going to be done with the emergency FMLA leave and the paid sick leave act on December 31st of this year. That's when FICRA expires for these purposes. However, normal FMLA continues. This is good and bad news for employers, but that the point being, if you have an employee who is sick for months with coronavirus or who has a child who is sick for months with coronavirus, they might still be eligible under normal FMLA based on that serious health condition. So don't lose sight of the potential application of FMLA beyond the Paid Sick Leave Act's requirements. Bob, I think that wraps it up for me. Unless you have specific questions I can help you with, I'm happy to answer any and all of those now or later.
Emily, I think you've done a great job of providing the overview. Quite obviously, there are details, very deep details as the law reads now, but as you mentioned, there are additional guidance that is coming down from labor and perhaps even Treasury. And you've mentioned companies consulting with their attorneys. If our listeners wanted to reach you, how would they get in contact with you?
Sure. You can find me on the Burr Foreman website, burr.com, B-U-R-R.com. Again, my name is Emily Killian. You can email me. It's E-Killian, K-I-L-L-I-O-N, at burr.com. Or you can reach me at 251-599-2107. And we are happy to assist with any types of questions as we're able. We represent a multitude of different employers and different industries of different sizes and with different needs. So we're happy to help. We know these are trying and uncertain times for employers that are faced with just really hard circumstances here. So, Bob, I appreciate your efforts to ease this transition for everyone, and certainly we attempt to do the same on our end, too.
Well, thank you very much, Emily. That's all the time that we'll have today. Our guest today has been Emily Killian with the Burr Foreman Law Firm. Again, this call was recorded and will be posted to the Chamber's social media channels later today. A reminder, you will find the latest resources and assistance related to COVID-19 on the Chamber's website. That's mobilechamber.com. Tomorrow's call will feature former Congressman Joe Bonner, who serves as the Chief of Staff for Governor Kay Ivey. Thank you for calling today and for your membership in the Mobile Area Chamber of Commerce.